Henry Mancini, please. Sunday night, and that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening, this is John McMullen, John Mack to some. Welcome you to the 205th episode of the weekly John Mack Radio Show. The links to the recordings of the previous 204 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C. So that's www.johnmack13.com, and look under the radio show tab. In addition to the previous radio shows, you'll also find links to my online daily newspaper at my web home. The newspaper is a curation of news articles from around the country and the world, articles relating to politics, sports, opinion, books, technology, and the environment. Write and subscribe only one email per day, and it's free. Once again, that's www.johnmack13.com. But I hope you'll join us not only tonight, but every week at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday evenings, either live or as most do, listen later. Next Sunday, my guest will be author, editor, documentarian, playwright, advertising executive, and teacher. Boy, that's a mouthful. That's Bob Zaslow. Now, to this week's show, the 205th, as I mentioned, callers may call them at any time during the show by dialing 646-716-9756. And that's 646-716-9756. But I usually hold callers until near the end of my interview with my guest. My guest tonight is the award-winning National Public Radio a New Delhi Bureau Chief Julie McCarthy, one of the most recognizable NPR voices and the real airways favorite of mine. Julie and I have been Facebook and email friends for a good while, but it was only when she returned to the U.S. for a short stay that logistics permitted her appearance on these microphones. Good evening, Julie, and welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, John. It's great to be here, and thank you for that very generous introduction.
So where'd you grow up and first go to early school?
I am speaking to you from just blocks from the house where I grew up. I grew up in what Garrison Keillor would call a tiny little town. Between Milwaukee and Chicago, a town called Kenosha. And from the time I was a little kid till now, I have seen sort of the transformation of this city go through boom and bust and boom and bust. And it was a car manufacturing town when I was growing up. And there was a lot of prosperity. There were a lot of blue-collar workers. There were a lot of white-collar workers. And increasingly, Kenosha became this bedroom community for Chicago. So there was this terrific mix of people here. And then we went the way of we're part of the Rust Belt. And the car industry died here. And along with it died many jobs. And people moved away. And it tries to come back and reinvent itself. So it reinvents itself as kind of a tech hub. Now an Amazon hub, and now they're in the running for some big contract to come from Foxconn. which is a Taiwanese company. And so it's had a lots of it's had troubled times, and it always seems to try to stumble back somehow. But that's where I grew up, and I'm sitting just blocks from the house I grew up in a house that's now mine. And we grew up right on Lake Michigan, so we were very, very fortunate. It was a kind of a dreamy childhood, John. You know, you grow up on a lake, and you learn to swim, you know, before you learn anything, because your mother's always worried about the lake. So I don't think my hair was dry from the time I was about 5 till the time I was 18. I was a big swimmer, still am. And so that's the town I grew up in. And it was about, you know, 100,000 people. It still is. But it's
Do you still have family there?
Changed. Oh, my, yeah, I still do have family here. My mother's here. I have brothers and sisters here. So yes, it is a place called home. So I have very deep roots here. My grandparents were here, and that really grounds you to a place. My grandparents were very old world. They were from Czechoslovakia, and they came to the States, and they continued a very European life. And we lived right next door to them, and they had root cellars, and they had rose gardens, and they made their own sausage and their own wine. And my grandfather did all manner of professions. And when I was growing up, he was a tailor, and he made all of our clothes. And, you know, you'd go to school, and the nuns were always examining your clothes and kind of wonder about where you got them. Tell them, well, my grandfather made them. It was a really interesting way to grow up. And my father was a Chicagoan, and they were all Irish, and they were a very fun-loving group, still are. So this is a place on the planet that is very near and dear to my heart. And so when I come home, I feel obviously a great sense of belonging. And but, you know, John, with my profession, you're always itching to get on the next plane. So there's always that push and pull.
Do you remember what your earliest aspirations were as a child?
You know, I wanted to be in television. I wanted to be a television producer. There was something about television as a little kid that drew me. And I guess, you know, that was the age of Lucille Ball, and that was, you know, that the age of those sort of wacky comedies, you know. And you grew up, and there was something so there was something sweet about it and exciting about it. And I'm from a very theatrical family, and so the stage drew me, you know, Broadway drew me, television drew me, and the law also drew me. So I ended up being trained as a lawyer. I never made it to Broadway. But when I was in law school, I said, okay, I'm going to be Nina Totenberg. that was my goal. I was going to be Nina Totenberg. And I
and then you
found
got to
my
meet her.
Way, actually, yeah, well, and she trained me, basically dangling me on her knees. She'd take me to court and cover the Oliver North trial. And yeah, so she was a brilliant teacher, and it was all kind of serendipitous, but not, you know. When I was in college, I first heard National Public Radio on the air. I heard Susan Stanberg and Bob Edwards do All Things Considered, and I kind of lodged that in the back of my head since the time I was 19 or 20. And when I got to Washington, I worked in a communications law firm with a couple of women who had basically been big shots at the Federal Communications Commission under Richard Nixon. And so I was kind of schooled in that, and I knew with a law book in a library is great, but I sort of needed to get out and, you know, meet the world. So journalism was a great way to do that. You could, and I had a great great kind of experimental laboratory kind of growing up or cutting my teeth in Washington, D.C., you were always in the courts. You know, there had been some calamity or, you know, some corruption deal. And so you found yourself in the courts a lot. And it was a great, it was a great training ground for finding inconsistencies in stories, you know, an inconsistency in a story, an inconsistency in someone's narrative. And lively, very lively. But, you know, John, I was drawn to the Hill for about a week. And I said, no, this just isn't. The Capitol Hill was just not for me. And I thought it was. I thought it was, you know. And I realized very quickly it just wasn't. So I covered things like the city. I actually covered the local scene of Washington, D.C., which is a very, very different kind of political gig. It was a wonderful laboratory for a young journalist.
Where did you go to college? What did you major in?
I went to the school at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, and I majored in history and English literature and political science. I had three majors.
Did you do any either radio or television work?
Because I didn't know what I wanted to do. No, I didn't. You know, I was basically on the other side of the microphone. I worked in the governor's office for, you know, since the time I was in school, which was great fun. And I worked in the press office. And I actually didn't get the bug until I went to Washington, D.C. And that thing that had been rolling around in the back of my head came to the foreground. I guess it was proximity. It was hearing it more. It was knowing it was possible because it was just down the street. You know, National Public Radio literally was just down the street from where you lived. And so it all seemed much more possible or plausible. I really thought, you know, in college that I was kind of bound for politics. That's what I loved. That's what I wanted to do. And then I kind of didn't really feel that was really what I needed to pursue. I wanted to pursue something else. Basically being on the other side of the microphone, asking the questions.
Now, you went to law school in D.C., though, didn't you?
Say again?
You went to law school in D.C., didn't you?
I went to law school in Washington, D.C., yes. I went to Antioch Law School in Washington, D.C., which was connected to Yellow Springs, Ohio. They had a law school right on 16th Street, about 12 blocks up from the White House. And it has since been absorbed into the University of the District of Columbia. And it was founded by two people who were very instrumental in the creation of the Corporation for Legal Services, again, in the late 60s, early 70s. And these people went off and started this university or started this law school. It was really about a hands-on education in terms of being in the courts. They wanted you in the courts. They wanted to see, you know, they wanted you to see really what a pleading was. They wanted you to see how you interact in a court. They wanted you to see and to come away with the understanding that so much of law is for the lack of a better word, widget work. It's hard slog work, you know. It's the hard slog plumbing, and the glory is 5 minutes in the courtroom. And you came to understand that, and actually they sort of were in the vanguard of very quickly afterwards. Every law school in the country followed suit. Everybody wanted to have a practical, hands-on part of the education rather than just have books and classrooms. You know, you were actually in the court. You were representing people under the guidance of lots of other people, but it was a different approach to law. That I think suited my personality, and I think it was a really smart thing to have done, because there's not a day that goes by, John, that I don't somehow reach back for that, because it teaches you how to critically think. It teaches you a lot of things about about framing an argument, you know, frame an argument, frame a story. So a lot of that stuff, a lot of that training was, well, I use it all the time. It was just a wonderful sounding board.
Now, while your entire radio career has been done with NPR and it's taken you all over the world, that made your voice highly recognizable, and we'll go through it step by step, but it began domestically as an editor, did it not?
It did begin domestically. I was a newscaster. I was the education correspondent, which was one of my favorite jobs. I was a weekend reporter, which meant you watched the morning news program and said what went on. I was an editor, absolutely. I had the great privilege, and I do consider it to be one of the most fantastic jobs I ever had. I was a European editor when the wall came down, when the Berlin Wall came down. And, John, I have to say, that was such a sense of exhilaration that sort of rippled through all of, certainly of Washington. There was a great sense of, joy, really, about what had happened and that the fact that it had happened peacefully and the fact that it had happened so swiftly was just an astonishing moment to not only have lived through, but to have been able to devise coverage over. So it was a really terrific job. And I was also the Africa editor, which was marvelous because I didn't know anything about Africa. The editing part of that was terrific fun. And I was the overnight foreign editor, which means you took in everything from overseas. And of course, when we're sleeping here in America, the world is awake, and much of the rest of the world is awake. And so it was a very busy job, and it was something that I pioneered and something they still have. And that was it. That was great fun. That was great fun.
While you were the European and the African editor, you won three awards, the Peabody and obviously Press Club and the George Polk Award. Tell us about the awards.
Wow. A lot of that had to do with the fall of the Berlin Wall and the Balkans War. The Balkans War was a terrifically sad affair, the expulsion of people left, right, and center from Kosovo and from Bosnia. And the great long, feuding war that came bubbling up from World War I against the Croats and the Serbs and the Bosnians. It was a terribly complicated war. And it was a dangerous place for our correspondents to have been because it was kind of a free-for-all. That was a Peabody Award. The Polk Award was much for the same thing. That was about the Bosnian conflict, and the Overseas Press Club Award was about a series we had done on the economics, really, the aftermath of the wall coming down a couple years later, and what had become of the states, what had become of these of the Eastern Bloc, and how they were faring. So it was all sort of, it was all long format stuff, and it was these were high drama stories because that was high drama time, and there was a lot of tension in that part of the world, and I make no claim on those awards. those were the times, you were just presenting the facts, ma'am.
They originally thought, as I'm sure you remember, that once the Iron Curtain came down, there were all these people that would be jumping up and down, they'd be welcoming us, they'd be democratic and all this. And all of a sudden, these people who, as you pointed out, have had animosities going back hundreds of years, they were picking up the guns and shooting each other. We would have thought that when we got to Iraq and a similar thing happened, the despot's boot went off, and that the Shiites and the Sunnis did start in with their hundreds of years of conflict. But But we seem to miss that. So I'm surprised. And then you went off to globe hopping.
This is
and
so interesting. You know, this is so interesting. You know, and you have to really wonder. I mean, I've often wondered about this. I mean, you know, when we talk about how, you know, Perestroika and Gorbachev coming along and Gorbachev being blamed for losing the Eastern Bloc. And, you know, you wonder, you know, where was the CIA all those years? I mean, if the Soviet bloc was crumbling, you know, if it was rotting from within, we certainly weren't told that. Quite the contrary. We were told, you know, it was a duel to the end and a death duel with weapons of mass destruction. And so you do wonder if in the bowels of you know, the State Department and the bowels of the CIA, if people really didn't know what the score was and that it was just a little too dangerous to talk about that because they thought maybe complacency was going to fit in or was going to set in. But that's not a narrative you ever hear. What we hear is we were taken by surprise, and you wonder how could you be taken by surprise? I think that's kind of amazing. And maybe in part – and this goes back to your comment about the Shias and the Sunnis. Maybe in part that has to do with the advanced technology of the United States and its reliance on technology for intel. If there's more human intelligence on the ground, you're going to learn more. And the interesting thing about that, John, is when WikiLeaks came out, I was in Pakistan. And you would often encounter – you would often encounter diplomats who would, you know, want to know from you, you know, so they'd want to know the inside track on what was happening in the country because they knew you were out there, because you were able to get out there, and a lot of them weren't able to get out there because there were such security constrictions put on them. But when you read WikiLeaks, you realized, at least I came away thinking, holy cow, these people knew more than we did. And so I concluded from that, we must have had some pretty good human intel on the ground to have known as much as we did know about places like Pakistan and what was brewing in the southern part of the country and these kind of breeder reactors of schools that were, you know, that were teaching fundamentalists, you know, in the way of thinking.
Supposedly, though, in the case of both the former Yugoslavia and in Iraq, that people would be riding to work with the next door neighbors and they'd all be hanging out together. And then all of a sudden, when the boots went away, they started shooting each other. So I don't think we ever could have understood that, do you?
Well, that's a very interesting question. You know, I think things get primal very quickly, I think is what the takeaway from those wars is. But that's true. I mean, people who were friends quickly became enemies. I just experienced that in doing a story on the 70th anniversary of the partition of the subcontinent, which,
at
stroke of midnight on August 15th, 1947 it was, 1947, the stroke of midnight, the state of Pakistan is born. It's a new nation. And India gains its freedom. And as Pakistan is born, it's born as an Islamic state. And all Hindus and all Sikhs were invited to leave. And people who, I mean, they just recently told me these harrowing stories about making it out of the country by the skin of their teeth. And many people didn't make it. I mean, we don't even know how many people were slaughtered in the division of the subcontinent that freed India from colonial rule and created Pakistan. But that was the same thing. People would tell you that they were they were all such close friends, and that was the end of it. You know, that nobody cared about that. When push came to shove,
thought that if Gandhi hadn't been assassinated, that wouldn't have happened. Do you believe that, or do you think that's just what people would like to say now?
Well, he was assassinated after partition, but a lot of people blame Nehru, you know, Jawaharlal Nehru, who was very, very close to Gandhi, who became the first prime minister, People like to ascribe blame. A lot of people blame Jenna, who you know, we read by some accounts of history, just got tired of waiting around for, you know, the Indian political elite to grant the greater Muslim community what he figured was their due right. And so there was, you know, there was a lot of blame assigning that went on, a lot of blame assigning that went on, and a lot of anger still today. And yes, it is directed. A lot of it's directed at Gandhi, and a lot of it's directed at Nehru. People would say to me, you know, Gandhi would fast to the death at the drop of a hat. Where was he during partition? Well, by the time partition came around, he had basically withdrawn from politics. He had sort of, in some ways, sort of figuratively thrown up his hands and said, I can't fix this. And people got very angry for the fact that, you know, there was a withdrawal from the great moment. Whether or not Gandhi could have reversed this is another issue altogether.
What led you to leave domestic and editing and wind up going off to be a foreign person, first in Tokyo and then in other places? What led you that way?
From the time I basically walked in the door, I had my Nina Totenberg-itis, wanting to be Nina Totenberg, which has really sort of never left my skin. I was a student of international affairs. I was very interested in that. I was pulled to that. I was pulled to the people who were on that desk. They were terrifically engaging and very smart and very savvy, and they taught me a great deal. I mean, those people taught me how to report. The people I edited were really my teachers. And so when I went out into the world, I went out into the world armed with, you know, with the lessons of some of the most, you know, accomplished people in the industry. So in some ways, it was what I always wanted to do because I always wanted to report. And I was at NPR at a time where you could sort of navigate from one place to another. I think it becomes more difficult to do that now. And so I could wear a lot of hats, and you know, as a young person, and I did wear a lot of hats. And then when I decided that I wanted to go overseas, they kind of looked at each other and said, "She wants to do what?" I said, "Yeah, I want to do that, and I want you to send me." So I won the door prize, no question about it. I had not been to Japan. I went to Japan for the first time on a fellowship with the East-West Center just before I took over just before I opened the bureau there. And I arrived in Japan, and I was just, my mouth was wide open. I thought, wow, so this is Japan. This is amazing. And then I went off to Middlebury College and studied Japanese. And so it was all, you know, just being sort of dipped in another world and in a fascinating part of the world with wonderful history. And, you know, John, when I washed up in Japan, it was the 50th anniversary the next year of everything, right? It was the 50th anniversary of the war. It was the 50th anniversary of dropping the bomb. And I have to say that being in Hiroshima for the 50th anniversary of the bomb was one of the most moving experiences of my life. And I said, wow, I would have to tell everybody, you know, your children and your grandchildren must come back here on anniversary day to see how they celebrate it, how they mark it. It was just this astonishing, sober, a beautiful, quiet. There are all these rivers that run through Hiroshima, and they set upon these beautiful lit lanterns, and they quietly just flow down the river. And the whole idea is that the souls of the dead are being taken into the other world. It was just the most incredible. It was the most incredible experience. And I remember it was about 104 that day, as it was the day the bomb was dropped. It was a searingly hot summer day. But to experience that and to talk to people who – who were there and lived through it. And the humility, that's the thing that struck me. The humility of the Japanese was just a it was a humbling experience. It was just a privilege, an absolute privilege.
Now, we're all used to you're on the air voice. The role of the bureau chief, which you've been all over the world for the last 23 years, involves much more than that. Could you explain to the audience what the non-on-air responsibilities of the position are?
Oh, what a good question that is, John. I think 85% of our lives are about admin. It's about administration. You know, when you run a bureau, you're managing people. You're trying to knock down, you know, the walls of power to get into whatever issue it is you're trying to get into. You're dealing with visas in places that oftentimes don't really want you in there, but you know you've got to get in there. So this takes a lot of time, a lot of trouble. And in a place like India, in a place like Pakistan, some places in the Middle East, obviously, and even in South America, you know, you're dealing with logistics that are made that much more cumbersome because there are no systems, really. I mean, a lot of things don't work. You know, so you know, you're fixing, you know, the air conditioning and the inverter and the generator doesn't work. And there's there's power outages all the time. So, you know, you're fighting things that you don't even, you know, that Americans don't even think about. And you're dealing and you're inhabiting societies that just move at a very different pace. You know, I often say to people in Washington, you know, you must realize I'm not in Cleveland. I'm not in Cleveland. I'm in Pakistan, and this is how it goes, right? It's very difficult for people to understand. In fact, John, it's impossible to understand that unless you live it, because some of that stuff is just so onerous that you deal with, but you deal with it, right? And so that takes up a big chunk of your day, and just trying to stay up with the news and, you know, you're reading 25 newspapers from the minute you get up in the morning, and I go to bed very late. Because the responsibilities are terrific, and there's just a lot of ball juggling, you know, to keep an operation going, and you've got to get out, you've got to be and then there's all the reporting. When that's all done, then you have to do your real job. So it's challenging. It's not for everybody. It certainly isn't for everybody. You got to love to get up in the morning and rub your hands together and say, well, who can I convert today? Because that's what you got to do every day. So it's been great fun, I have to say. Yeah, I wouldn't change a thing.
Now, in the 5 years you were there, there were more awards. There was the East-West Center Journalism Fellow Award. There was the Mary Morgan Hewitt Award for the Advancement of Journalism, and there was something from the Overseas Press Club. Could you tell us about those?
The Overseas Press Club was about economics of Asia, and it was a series of stories that covered all of East Asia and how they were faring economically. So that was a great honor to receive that. The Peabody Award, when I was in Pakistan, I have to tell you that one is it was just such a terrific honor because that's a global. I mean, the applicants are global, so it's a global competition. And so when you're awarded that, it just kind of comes out of nowhere. You can't even believe it. And again, you know, I was there at a time when, you know, the Taliban was overrunning things. The Taliban was overtaking the army headquarters, for gosh sakes. You know, Osama bin Laden had been captured. There was a 500-year flood. You know, so in many ways, John, if you just told the story, you know, someone was going to notice, right?
you're in the place,
the
right?
The stories were so huge. You know, the stories were so huge, and I was just very lucky to have inhabited that country at that time. That was an astonishing time to be there. And I have to say, I went to Pakistan never having been there. I never did a recce.
Well, all of these places, after being in Japan and settling in, you mentioned learning the language, you're off to London. What took you there from Japan?
A midnight call in Indonesia asking me to go to London from my boss. And I said, what happened to Beijing? That was my plan. No can do right at the moment. We need you in London. So I remember hanging up the phone, feeling very disconsolate, and calling my friends in Japan and saying, you're not going to believe what happened. And they started cheering and clapping and saying, we're going to London too. So remarkably, a bunch of us from Japan went off either to the Middle East or to London. So it was a funny migration that way that I have to say, John, made things a lot easier. Of course, it was funny when I washed up again in London, because when you come to London, you know, I remember there was going to be, the week I arrived, a total eclipse of the sun down in the south of the country. And I said, oh, there's a great story. And it happened to be, and the total eclipse was going to fall just as our A segment was going on the air for Morning Edition. That's the lead segment of the show. I said, oh, this is a no-brainer. Let's go down there. So I went to Waterloo Station to buy a train ticket. And I said, I need the speediest train down to, and I had just come from Japan, right, where there is bullet trains left, right, and center. And he said, oh, okay, well, you'll want to leave at 6 in the morning, you'll be there by 4 in the afternoon. I said, no, I need an express train. He said, that is the express train. So you really had to downshift when you left, East Asia, where everything's go, go, fast, fast, you know, get you there fast, do it fast. You know, Europe's got a different, Europe just works on a whole different kind of clock, which was a kind of a revelation. But London was magnificent.
That also took you to the Middle East during Iran, didn't it?
Yes. I actually lived in the Middle East, but I was there for the Second Intifada. But that's right. In many ways, London is a fireman's post. In other words, you're shot out into Europe, you're shot out into Africa, you're shot out into the Middle East when there are big stories. Eventually, I ended up in the Middle East, and from there, I did cover the Iraq War. But mostly, I shouldn't say mostly. I mean, there was so much going on. There was the whole Saudi tensions, and Egypt was making soundings even back then. But the Middle East conflict then was defined as the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
And you spent 3 years in East Jerusalem. That must have been very interesting.
Oh, it was a fantastic time. It was a wonderful, wonderful time. The people were great. The Israelis were great. The Palestinians were great. It was a sad story, but you know, you would try to find, you know, stories about the culture, et cetera, et cetera. But it was very tough about it, because people really had deep, deep feelings about, you know, what was said, how it was said. And again, your legal training came into play every day. You were dotting all your I's and crossing all your T's and looking at your commas, just to make sure you were trying to do the right thing. It was tremendous. And, you know, when I came away, you know, it was interesting. I would go to Iraq and I would stand there and I'd say, you know what, 10 years from now, these Iraqis are going to be fine. They're going to get it together. They're incredibly smart people. They're savvy people. They're highly educated. You know, so you would stand there and say, they're going to get it together. This is going to work. And then you'd go home to, you know, you'd go home to Jerusalem and say, wow, how is this going to end? You know, how will this end? It was just an interesting perspective. And so here we are many years later, and Iraq is a very, very, it's a very, very tenuous state. It's in a tenuous state. So, Yeah, you can never predict these things.
I used to be very, very negative on the Mideast, thinking that it was never going to work, and it was really made more positive when Ireland and South Africa seemed to get it together after hundreds and hundreds of years of conflict and segregation by religion or by economics or by color. But it hasn't all been smooth, and obviously that hasn't worked in Israel and Palestine yet, but maybe it will. Who knows? Then you're off to South America. Now, were you learning languages the way you learned Japanese as you went along?
I was studying Arabic, and you're studying, you know, you go and study, you know, Portuguese and study Spanish. Yeah, you're always trying to grab the languages. Yeah, I spent, I was in Mexico studying these languages. And then I went to Rio de Janeiro. And what was wonderful about that, John, is that you had a huge continent. See, I was used to covering continents. I like covering continents. When I was in Tokyo, basically you covered all of, you know, you covered Indonesia and you covered the Philippines and you covered, you know, Southeast Asia and you covered Taiwan. And so, I mean, you just had in South Korea, just in North Korea. I mean, you just had this huge swath. And that was Brazil. Every country was different. Each culture was different. The cuisine was different. Their touchstones similar, but they had their own unique way of looking at their world and themselves. And that was just a ball. I mean, roaming around South America, and what I mean by covering a continent, there was really nobody there. I mean, meaning to say, it was me, the New York Times, and the Wall Street Journal. That's really who was in Rio de Janeiro, in Bloomberg. So you had this broad, wide continent, and you were never really worried about, you know, tripping over people. It was just an incredible, beautiful and welcoming place. And I got very lucky. I got there at a time where the quote-unquote pink revolutions were washing through. Evo Morales came to power and Hugo Chavez came to power and Lula was in power in Brazil and the Kirchners were in power in Argentina and Bachelet came to power in Chile, who had been a dissident during Pinochet's time and lived long enough to become the leader of that country. So it was a really interesting political time to have arrived in South America.
I know that you covered some volcanoes in Chile, and you just come out of war zones in Northern Africa and in the Mideast. How do you handle the danger that you have to expose yourself to as a foreign correspondent?
You know, that's such an interesting question. In war zones, I think it's about being really alert to your surroundings, not being a kind of a cowboy, cowgirl. And I have to say, John, knocking on wood, being lucky, you know, you have to be alert to, you know, everything around you. And you have to, you know, we go into hostile training environments, you know, where they kidnap you and they take you through your paces. And I mean, obviously that's no substitute for the real thing, but there's an attempt to sort of familiarize you with what could conceivably, you know, be facing you one day. But I think, you know, the most important thing about the hostile training is the first aid component of it. You know, if someone is seriously hurt, what you can do to help save somebody's life. And that way, I think that training is extremely valuable. In fact, one woman told us that She had gone to a hostel training. This was in the English countryside. We were at hostel training in the English countryside. And one woman said that she had gone through a course earlier, and she was at the gym, and somebody in the gym had a heart attack. And she basically knew what to do until the medics got there. So, you know, in part, she helped save somebody's life. So, you know, it's that. It's preparation. You know, it's communication. It's having the right equipment when you go in. It's making sure, you know, you have the right body armor when you go in. It's making sure you have body armor when you go in. It's making sure you have the sat phones, you know, that actually fire, or the Thoraya phone that fires that allows you to communicate. Your vectors, where are you? So you can tell Washington back in the States where you are, that you're okay, that you're in trouble. So it's a complicated thing when you go into cover a war. I think when you go into cover natural disasters, I covered quite a few of those. It's a different thing. You have your first aid kit with you, and in many ways, that is, those are endurance tests, right? Because you're not going to sleep for 3 days. Because, you know, the story really in the aftermath of an earthquake is what's happening most immediately around you. And in the case of Kobe, which fundamentally burned to the ground in Japan, that all happened in a flash. And that story happened very fast, and it came to a climax very quickly. And, you know, then a year later you would go back, or through the months you'd go back and see how they were rebuilding the place. So in natural disasters, I think it's really, you got to try to keep your cool when all heads are losing theirs around you, because it can happen easily, particularly in an earthquake. Aftershocks, people get very, very rattled. In Nepal, we were driving up into the mountains, and the driver was riding along, and we're in this muddy patch, and then there's a sheer cliff, and everyone in this car started screaming. And, of course, my job has to be to try to calm everybody down so that the driver isn't rattled. In many ways, it's just kind of trying to manage risk and manage your fear and manage the fear of other people around you. But
have you ever...
The volcano story in Chile was really rather remarkable, because a lot of these stories, John, will tell you so much about the country, because you're in places in those countries that you normally wouldn't be. Right? So I'm in Chile, and I'm saying to myself, wow, this is really a country in serious distress. This is a major city, and the poverty level in this major city is really quite eye-popping. And then I had the great, great good fortune to go to the island of Chiloé, off the coast of Chile, where Darwin had studied. And it was a wonderful place full of magic and goblins and ghosts, and they still believe in all that. You know, they still believe in all of that. They believe in the spirits, and it's also a great place for the missionaries had come, and it's a collection of beautiful old mission churches. So that was a wonderful kind of a fairy wonderland tale just across from the volcano.
Have you ever been in the situation where you just say, "What in hell am I doing here right now?" You know,
in
a war zone or in a natural thing. Why am I here? You know.
Oh wow! You know, that's very interesting. I have never had that question come up in my mind, because your mind is concentrated on the moment and surviving. But I have to say, I guess the closest I ever got was in Iraq, and going into the city of, where were we? I think it was Fallujah, outside Fallujah. And there had been the traffic just came to an absolute standstill, and that's the last thing you want, right? You just don't want that to happen, because you want to be able to move. And I remember also being in the West Bank, with an older fixer, you know, someone who comes along with you and guides you through things. He was an older gentleman, and I said, well, let's try to get into novelist. And it turns out that novelist was a closed military zone, and the closer we got in these back roads to novelist, people would just look at us and kind of wave, like, lots of luck. You know, they'd stand there and just wave. And I remember these Jeeps tearing past us and then stopping in front of us and saying, you know, ordering us out of the car, get out of the car. And I said, I don't want to get out. I screamed back and said, I don't want to get out of the car because I don't want to get shot. And then this sort of exasperated voice came back and said, I'm not going to shoot you. Get out of the car. And so I said, why don't you come here? So he said, oh, my God, all right. So the soldiers come, and they ask my driver for his identification. And, of course, he doesn't have it. And he turns to me and he says, well, it was in my pants, and I put it in the washer, and now it's all washed away. And I'm looking at him. I'm dying, and I'm thinking, we are never going to get out of here. We are not going to get out of here. They're going to take us into custody. This is not a good scene. But they had mercy on us. They were quite empathetic and said, just turn around and get out of here now. And I lost a notebook with that same gentleman in another part of the West Bank. It slid off the back of a car, and we went racing out of there. And I said, my whole life is in that notebook. I've got to go back there. And it was at night, and you just don't drive from the West Bank at night. But we went back there, and we went knocking on all these stores. And I was in a parking lot where I thought I could have conceivably have lost this. And we walked into a store, and this man said, oh, there's a little girl come. She came in here, and she was bragging about the fact she found a notebook, and she was practicing her English. And I said, where is she? Where does she live? Sure enough, we went to the house. We actually found that little girl and found the notebook. And she was gracious enough to part with it. But, yeah, you have these crazy kind of hijinks, you know, episodes.
Okay, that's terrific. Then after South America, there was never a full-time bureau in Pakistan until they sent you. What led to that assignment happen?
Well, during the 2008 political campaign, the presidential campaign, Barack Obama talked a great deal about Pakistan, a lot about Pakistan. And there was great interest in Pakistan. And frankly, John, I knew, every time I went to headquarters, they'd be sort of rubbing their hands going, oh, gee, Julie, what are we going to do about Pakistan? And I'd say, gee, 8:30, I've got to get on a plane. And I realized, you can either be dragooned into service or you could step up to the plate. And I knew that Rio de Janeiro was probably the easiest place to fold. And so I said, I'll go to Pakistan, and here's what we're going to do. And they said, sounds good. When can you leave? So I returned to Rio de Janeiro and packed up and headed off to Pakistan.
You're also, once you got there, you're responsible for not only the radio station people, but you're responsible for security, for hiring security people. How did you have the background to do that?
Oh, that was such an interesting undertaking, actually. I went to a lot of the various providers of security. And they are all local because Pakistan prohibits international security people from working inside the country. So they were all local security people. And, you just had to interview them and find out how they did, what they did. And then I said, this is like eeny, meeny, miny, moe. It was so serendipitous, right? And first of all, I knew I didn't want anybody armed. I wanted nobody armed because that's just – That's an invitation to trouble, meaning to say accidents happen when there are these big rifles around, big guns around. And so I decided that I had to go and talk to the security people at the American Embassy. And I said, how do we do this? Because we need security at our, you know, where we live and where we work. And they were, the guy who ran security for 30 years at the embassy, and said, he said, I will, you know, I'll help you if you need me to vet these people. And so he came over and he looked at these people and he talked to these people and he'd say, not this guy, this guy, not this guy, this guy. So, I mean, that was a, you know, that was, I have to say, we would mostly likely have reached the same conclusions, but it was, you know, it was reassuring to know that, that somebody who was in that world and knew what kind of questions to ask people was willing to help. And so that was, yeah, the security thing was always a tricky deal, always a tricky deal. I remember when we moved to the house, I said, we got to raise the wall. I told the landlord, we got to raise the wall. And he was very quick to understand that. And he raised the wall by around the house by 3 feet. I said, but you got to lose this razor wire. We can't look like we're, you don't want to look like you're a compound, because that just kind of draws, you know, that draws a little bit too much attention. So you want to look like you're an average Pakistani just living in your house. But that was a terrific challenge setting up the bureau in Pakistan, because we had absolutely nothing and nobody wanted to go in with me. They told me I was crazy for wanting to, other colleagues would say, you're crazy for wanting to do this. Why would you do this? I said, well, because we have to get out of these, we have to get out of these places we're staying in currently. We have to get out of these places that we're currently staying because, forgive me one second. Because they're known. They're now known, you know, that we stay here. So that wasn't too reassuring. So I was all in for getting out, and it just came at a crazy time. The Taliban was really rearing its head, and they had taken over Army headquarters, as I mentioned earlier. And I just made the decision one weekend. I said, that's it. We're moving now, and we're going to do this now. And I don't care what the news business is going to happen. We have to do this now, or we're never going to do it. So we did it, and we set it up, and we set up generators, and got the people come in and put in special, you know, stuff all over the glass to make sure when it shattered, it doesn't shatter in a million pieces your way, and put bars all over the wall, all over the windows, and I mean it was a substantial undertaking, just the infrastructure alone in a place like that. And, you know, but John, I have to say, I don't know, is that, you know, it gives you a sense of security, but the truth of the matter is all that stuff is just mitigation. None of that stuff is going to save you in the end. It maybe just slows somebody down. Let's put it that way. And then I built a safe room in that house and trying to figure out where's the safe room going to go. And yeah, it was, That was a very serious logistical undertaking.
While you were there, you didn't only win the Peabody Award. You won the Media Award as Correspondent of the Year. You won something from the South Asian Journalist Association. Tell us about those.
Oh, the South Asian Journalist Association was something so near and dear to my heart because it was the Environmental Award. And it was the Environmental Award for the coverage of Pakistan's own 500-year flood. So what we did, I remember I was on the phone with Washington with one eye on the television, and I'm saying to my editor, you can't believe what's happening up in Swat Valley, which was near the Himalayas and this beautiful spot. They call it the Switzerland of Pakistan. And it was this beautiful place that was – basically underwater, this huge flood that were coming down from the Himalayan mountains. And I was watching this man, he was tying himself around the razor wire of his own farm so he wouldn't float away. And I said, oh, there's something happening here. This is extraordinary. This is water like you've never seen. And so we started at the very top of the country and followed the Indus River, which had flooded, all the way down until where it drains into the Arabian Sea. And it was the most extraordinary trek, John, because you got to see places that you would not have seen, that the Army would not have let you see. You know, you were limited in Pakistan you know, to where you could go. And they made sure if you've turned up in a place and it wasn't in your visa, you and they discovered that, you know, you would be asked to leave. But, you know, in calamity, there's opportunity. And it was an opportunity to see the people and how they came together and how they survived and how the country lived. I remember being in one of the – in southern – In the Sindh province, way in the south, where the Bhutus hail from, and being in their ancestral village, and I have to say, John, being shocked at the level of poverty in the ancestral village of the Bhutus, and right outside the ancestral village is this enormous mausoleum built to these people, and you realized how, you know, what did governing really mean? You know, what did governance in that in the name of the people really mean? If this is how they This is how they had to live. It was just an extraordinary thing. So that prize was very, very meaningful to me. And the Peabody was obviously, you know, a huge, huge, huge honor. That was for everything we had done that year, from driving with truck drivers who actually went into Afghanistan and had to combat the Taliban as they delivered supplies to the American forces. Kind of an amazing story. So that, and there were, you know, a lot of stories about women that were involved in that, and the floods and the environment, and the stories of people who just survived under improbable circumstances and managed to sort of radiate a sense of goodwill and warmth and a sense of life affirming. So they were all just tremendous honors, I have to say.
What caused you then to move across the border to New Delhi? Is there still an Islamabad bureau there after you left? Or?
After I left, it was kind of, you know, people would go in and out, but it wasn't sort of up and running for a while, and then someone was there part-time, and then now there is someone there full-time, just joined this summer. And I had decided that I had said what needed to be said. Osama bin Laden had been captured. The country was in a, you know, great turmoil. We covered all of that. And my feeling was I what I could say about Pakistan, I said. And when you reach that point, you know it's time to look for other pastures. And so there were lots of places on the table, from Cape Town to Moscow, to India. I actually went to Moscow. It's very near and dear to my heart. And I was, that was my heart, but my head was in India. And I said, why am I leaving the big act's next door? I should probably just cross the border. And it was a very tough decision, but I tell you, I literally walked the floor night and day trying to make up my mind on that. Was it going to be Moscow or was it going to be India? And I flipped a coin three times, and it came up India three times. And so India it was. I crossed the border.
Now, did you learn another language, or how did you get by in India?
I can understand it, but I have trouble speaking it. But yeah, I struggle with that. And the truth of the matter is, I came away kind of learning that I could either, for me anyway, and I come from a family of linguists. My dad was a linguist, and my brother picks up languages like lint, and so does my mother. I really have to study a language, and I know how many hours that takes. And so I came from thinking I can even study the language, or I could do my job, because my job is an 18-hour-a-day proposition, in no matter what country you're in. That's just a fact of life. So I always made a point of trying to study it, but I was always, always had that clung in your stomach about knowing how you were not going to master it, because you just couldn't dedicate the kind of time you really needed to dedicate, or that kind of time because of the way I learned languages, needed to dedicate to it. But yes, I do try to hunker down.
We have a caller on the phone. Let me pick up the caller from the 917 area code. I believe this is a person that spent some time both in in Vietnam during the war, and then
wow.
part of that in Okinawa. Am I correct?
Oh, wow.
Are you talking about me, John?
I am.
No, I didn't.
Do you have a question for Julie, Chick?
Excuse me? Address Julie.
Do you have a question? Yes.
Oh, no. Well, you know, I'm listening, and I was fascinated. A lot of those places I've been in and working, totally different jobs.
Uh-huh.
I was a merchant seaman or a U.S. Marine or just a guy traveling around Asia. Karachi was, I had great laughs and experiences in Karachi, and first of all, I wondered how you easily comfortable being a woman in those societies. I couldn't
great
imagine.
Great question. That is a great question. Forgive me, what is your name?
My name is Chick or Chicky Donahue.
Chicky Donahue.
Julie,
Chick,
just some background.
Yeah.
Chick's from my old neighborhood in New York. And
oh,
Chick was a...
Oh, great.
Chick, the high school dropout who joined the Marines, who got the GED in the Marine Corps. Then he was the merchant seaman and then a bar owner. And during his time, the Vietnam War, people were concerned that there were people over there who were from the neighborhood and didn't feel they were getting support from the United States. So someone said someone ought to go and buy those guys a beer. And Chicky wound up doing that, bringing over some pastel ribbon, hitching around through war zones, getting caught in the Tet Offensive. And,
wow.
And this is all subject of the book by him and Joanna Malloy, ex of the New York Daily News. Then he came back and he became the Sandhog, and then he wound up getting the master's from Harvard without having the college degree. So, and then he went back to being the Sandhog. So that's Chick's background. Chick, you had told me the story about getting out to the black area in South Africa where you weren't supposed to be. Why don't we go to your question to Julie about being a woman over there, but then we'll come back to your experience in desegregated South Africa. No, go ahead, Julie.
Chicky, I think this is one of the most it's a terribly intriguing question, because I did inhabit societies and cultures that they don't treat their women well. There's a great deal of discrimination against women, and they don't think twice about it. Japan is one of them. But I have to tell you, I mean, Japan and the Middle East and, you know, macho cultures of South America, and certainly Pakistan, and certainly you can say the same thing about India. These places the world tends to give you or tends to kind of conspire on your behalf. If you are not one of those, if you're not Japanese or you're not, you know, Brazilian or you're not Pakistani, if you are a foreigner and you're a woman and you're a reporter in many of these countries, Saudi Arabia most prominently springs to mind, you are given entree into a whole world that my male counterparts could never get into, and that's women. So that, in that respect, you had entree into a whole stream of interesting social and cultural experiences, you know, that were unique to women. But I felt as if certainly in Japan, that, you know, you were the other that somehow was exempt from that kind of treatment. You were almost you were neutral, you know, almost androgynous, and therefore you weren't really, truly on the receiving end of that stuff. That's not to say it didn't exist. That's not to say that people weren't patronizing. But by and large, I never felt a heavy hand of serious exclusion. Quite the contrary. In fact, when I went to Japan, people would say to me, "Oh no, Japan. Oh no, how are you going to go there as a radio reporter? No one's going to talk to you." Let me tell you, the Japanese were some of the chattiest people I encountered overseas. And they were earnest when they talked to you, and you could see their minds working when they talked to you. They were just so interesting and very, very talkative. So there tends to be a lot of counterintuitive things that happen when you turn up in a country. And that turns a lot of stereotypes on their heads.
I totally agree. Totally agree. I turned up in Japan at the age of 17, not knowing why they even sent me there. I was in the Marines, 17-year-old kid. They said, "This is where you're going, bup, bup, bup." And obviously they transported me there. And I wound up spending most of my time guarding the spy plane, the U-2, which I didn't
wow.
even know it was a spy plane. And I had a lot of time off, so here I was, this 17-year-old kid, exploring Atsugi, Japan. The name of the town was Yamato-shi. And I met a man there who owned a bar that I went in.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw him in Yokohama about 2 weeks after I arrived in Japan. And he was inebriated, and a cop was about to take him away. And I asked the policeman. At that time, they all had to speak English. This was 1959. They all had to speak English. The police.
Wow.
And I asked the policeman, was he from Yamato-shi? And he determined that he was. So could you put him in a cab? I'll take him to Yamato-shi. And in the center of Yamato-shi was like a big telephone booth with a lot of glass, a lot of window. And the policeman would always be sitting in there. So I took the taxi to that policeman, and they took him to his house. And the next day I'm walking through town, and the man's pointing at me and sort of yelling in Japanese. I didn't know what it was. And as it turned out, he was inviting me to his home. And when they got a translator. So I went to his home, and I met his wife, and I met his two daughters and a son. They were all in high school. And it was very important to them at the time that the children be proficient in English. So I wound up living in the house, and it was like a good Irish Catholic house for young people like myself. No sex, but you could have sake and you could eat well, and it was fantastic. By the time I left there, a little more than a year later, I was speaking Japanese very well, because the father never said a word in English to me. Mama-san.
Oh, wow.
Mama-san said a few words, very few, but the children and I conversed in English. So I picked up Japanese, when I left the States and went there, I was very sad. I was leaving the safety of my home. I didn't know where I was going.
Yeah.
When I left Tokyo Bay a year or so later, I was in tears. I loved the place. And I love the people, and they treated me like one of theirs. And 30 years later or so, after my daughter graduated from Fordham, she went there as a teaching assistant and lived similarly with a Japanese family, and she became part of their family. And
that's wonderful.
I love traveling around the world. I loved meeting people, but I think I heard it in you. You can't have fear. Fear wasn't part of it. You always had to be on your guard. But I went to grade school via the subway, and I went to high school in Harlem, and so I lived in the city. I always was on my guard. It was like that's how you lived as a young man in the city anyway, and you have to have an attitude that, hey, I'm here. And people sort of looked at you. You were at a place to begin with. And they looked at you like, well, if he's here or she's here, in your case, they must be here for a reason, and they must be associated with something or connected to something. And they sort of like cooperated more with you or gave you a wider berth.
Yeah. People are very interested about why you turn up.
Exactly. Exactly.
When Jay was hitchhiking through Vietnam delivering the beer because he was in civilian garb, the military decided he was CIA. They never asked him, but they let him do more or less what he wanted to, which he was very lucky to do.
Wow.
Julie, you've been now in India for 5 years. What's next for you?
Well, that's another great question. I'm giving a lot of thought to that. But I just want to say something about Vietnam, since you mentioned Vietnam, really in the beginning of what Chiki was saying. You know, I was one of the first places I'd ever been in Asia, and I absolutely loved it. Hanoi was this magical city where they would, you know, they could fix anything. If you rounded the corner and you had, you know, a flat tire, they'd take the tire off in 3 seconds, and there was, you know, boiling water and cudgels flying, and they'd serve you tea and send you on your way in 10 minutes, you know, with your car fixed. There was something about this, you know, and there was just something about Vietnam to me that was so, well, you know, and I guess as an American, you know, you do have the, you know, they have the graciousness of the victor, and they were very, very generous to Americans. And I think they still are. In fact, I was just back there recently in June and back in Hanoi, and I realized that, it's such a there's something the food is fantastic, and there's something about the way they handle adversity. There's something about how they have one foot in the past, in their cultures and their tradition, and one foot in the future. And Vietnam is very aligned that way, and I think that's a lot of East Asia, which is powerful. It's a very powerful set of dynamics, and I think which is propelling them, you know, into the 21st century. Which brings me to India, which is where, you know, sort of India is. It's this go-go on one level, and still, you know, hanging back with traditions and arguably traditions that hold them back. The way they treat women, the caste system, that aren't going to be let go or forgotten easily. What's next on the agenda? I'm mulling all those over, John. We'll see.
Is it close? You wrapping up India, or are you going to be around for a while?
Yes. You know, I'll be around for a while, but not forever.
Okay. We've covered Chick, did you have anything else? Yes, Julie?
No, but I went back to Vietnam 7 or 8 years ago, and I'm going back January for the 50th anniversary of Tet. I happened to be at the embassy that morning when they occupied the embassy. And I had a week of experiences in Saigon that time. And I'm going back there with my wife, and we're going to go back to the Majestic Hotel down on what used to be Tudor Street in the river, and just spend a week walking around them places. And I'm hearing all sorts of stories about how it's been so developed now. I don't want it to be developed. I don't think anybody who was there during the war wants to go back and find a developed country. They have their memories, and they want to go back and see something that resembles their memories, not modern skyscrapers or whatever. And so I checked it out seven, 8 years ago. I found it that way, and I'm going to go back and just hang out there for a week.
How wonderful. Have a marvelous time. But yeah, I know people do. We have this. We have these ideas frozen in our mind about how things should be, the way they should be. I went back to Japan a few years ago, and it made me very sad.
Exactly.
And I remember standing at Ginza and looking at Ginza, and you know, it was just, you know, when I was there, it was this teeming, throbbing, you know, neon lit place, and I remember thinking, oh, Ginza, it's so tiny. You have all these. It's sort of, you know, like going back to your childhood home, having these revelations about a place. But yeah, that's true. We all want them to be sort of frozen in time, but time marches on.
I did the same thing in Japan. I went to Yamato-shi, and there was nothing. There was nothing as I
wow.
remembered it. And I lived there for a year
wow.
every day, and
yeah.
I couldn't find
wow.
anything.
Oh, that's rather shattering.
But I'm still glad I went and looked.
Yeah. We've covered
yeah.
a lot of ground tonight. What else would you like the audience to know about Julie McCarthy?
What would I like them to know? I'd like people to know that the world is, as many people know this, it's a wondrous place, and it is a privilege to inhabit other cultures. It is incumbent upon us who travel around to try to be good guests, which sometimes is difficult, but you have to be. And that's, you know, you kind of stand your ground, but you also have to honor the fact you are someplace else. And to understand the deep importance of understanding the world, because if nothing else, it gives us a sense of empathy. And I think a sense of empathy is what keeps peace in the world. And I think that's a very important thing for us to know and to think about. And it behooves people to try to understand what's going on in the world. And it's a very difficult thing to do because of the way the news operations now work. Everybody's sort of pulled back from their overseas bureaus, and news comes in little bites, and they think people don't have an appetite for the attention span to understand things. I don't think that's true. And so I think it's my life has been dedicated to trying to help people understand and be entertained or be elucidated or educated somehow about some little corner of the world that maybe they didn't know about. And
Do you ever see yourself returning to the United States to work?
Oh, sure. Yes, I do. I do, because I think there's terrific opportunities here, and there's a lot of work here in terms of trying to understand things and exploring things in a deeper kind of way. I mean, I'm becoming more and more a fan of long format journalism, and I think there's a place for it. And yes, certainly. The American stream of events, the American issues, and they resonate all over the world. I mean, healthcare resonates all over the world. Everybody's grappling with that, right? And, you know, how are you going to feed your family, and how are you going to educate your children, and how do you achieve a more equitable society? I mean, these are things that people are grappling with, you know, all over the world. And power doesn't yield easily, as we see all over the world. So there's huge tasks before us to talk about what is happening in the world and how are we connected to it. And being connected to it, I think, at some point means coming home.
Julie, thank you very much for this evening. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much, John. The pleasure's been all mine.
A bit of commercial information. My books are available at Amazon, and I blog at medium.com and publish the daily paper mentioned above. Send any questions to me about the show to johnmack13@gmail.com. And in the words, the Mets radio announcer, Howie Rose, after the Mets win, put it in a book. Go to my website and And I hope you'll join us next week for my interview with Bob Zaslow, and every other week at 7 p.m. And let's go off with the song that was written in the Midwest by Hoagy Carmichael.
Sometimes I wonder why I spend the lonely night.
Thank you, Chick, and
thank you, John. Great night. I really enjoyed myself.
Chick, you were great.
Thank you, Drew. I didn't. Thank you. I think you should come back and teach.
I'm sorry I didn't catch that.
You have a lot to pass.